Hey everyone, welcome back to the show. Wherever you are, whenever you're listening, you are listening to the Dom and Colin podcast. I'm Colin and I'm here with Dom. Dom, how are you doing this week?
I'm all right. How are you?
All right, I'll take it. I'm feeling fine as usual. You know, coming up today, we're going to be breaking down, talking all about episode 4 of Survivor Caramoan. However, before we get into that, just a couple of things that we definitely want to let you guys know about. First of all, we've gotten a ton of great feedback, actually, about our episode that we did talking about TV in general and the whole grand scheme of things and how reality TV really became what it is as we know it today with the reality TV professor himself, Max Dawson. All of the credit for which all of the positive feedback credit goes to Max, first of all, clearly. But definitely check that out if you haven't yet. And secondly, just put up our latest retrospective, this time with Johnny Fairplay. A ton going on in there. If you are a fan at all of Survivor, which I'm guessing you probably are considering you're tuned in at this point already, you definitely don't want to be missing that. So subscribe on iTunes to make sure you get both of those and all of our future episodes. Dom, anything else about those? Yeah.
Yeah, not much more to add. The Max Dawson interview is not really what we usually do. It's kind of a departure from our usual format, but I think there's a lot of interesting stuff there, so definitely check that out if you're interested in reality TV and the evolution of TV in general. And yeah, the Fabulous cast, I think, just go and listen to it. There's nothing I could say could really add to the hype there, but definitely worth checking out.
Definitely. So with that out of the way, I think let's get into episode 4 of Survivor Caramoan. And, you know, last time, before we get into the actual episode itself, last week we lost hope. And I know last week on the podcast we did kind of an abbreviated version. We'd been running a little late, but, you know, shocking stuff, I'm sure. So we didn't get to talk a ton about hope. So closing thoughts on that before we get into this.
Well, I guess the big question the Hope's about to lead is, who is she closer to, Kim or Pafty?
Okay, see, and this is Dom's referencing our preseason analysis podcast where we took the 2 or 3 minute video clips from CBS.com and made some very bold predictions about all of these new cast members, considering we hadn't met them. And Hope was the one that I compared to, not as a player, but her vibe when speaking to Parvati and Kim Spradlin. Now, obviously, those are some very big shoes to fill as a game player. They may be, either of them could be theoretically the best of all time. I'm not so bold to say who is. They're both certainly in the discussion, and obviously, Hope did not live up to that. So,
I'm not buying this excuse, because when you talk about you get the same vibe from her, what else could you be referring to?
She seems flirty and a fan of big earrings with both, you know, there's some Parv, there's some Kim for you. I don't know. This is the thing. We just saw so little of Hope on TV that I swear to you, I feel like I would like to go back and watch that clip again. And I would highly advise everyone else go back and watch that clip again, because it's certainly more than you're going to see of Hope at all this season or that we have seen so far.
Some people might say that we didn't really see enough of her on the show to really get a sense of what she's like on the show or in person, but I feel like there's a reason for that. If you watch, I guess she had one or two secret scenes or clips on the CBS website or something. There's nothing there from what I can tell.
Yeah, see, I haven't looked into any of that. I wasn't really dying to go look up all of Hope's bonus content.
I can imagine. The new thing seems to be just picking people at random and comparing them to past Survivor winners. Like, we had the whole Hope debacle, and now I think a few weeks ago you compared Matt to Chris Doxy. I'm really curious to see who the next one's going to be.
Oh, there's plenty more Matt equals Chris Doherty coming up. That was that's something I definitely want to be getting to later today, because I still will fully be standing by that. So more on that when we get into that, or when we start talking about that episode. So just one other thing that I think I want to get into before we talk about, talk about this episode that just aired last week. And yes, it is last week at this point. We are recording this on Tuesday with a new episode soon to come. But before, we were talking a little bit off air, and this is something I know you wanted to talk about more. It's from a little while ago, but I still think it's certainly something worth considering, which is Corinne and Malcolm and their decision in the first round to which side to go with, because that's obviously going to be playing a key role in things coming up.
Okay, so I brought this up last week because Corinne had been complaining on Twitter about the fact that she, along with a few other people on the tribe, didn't really have any pregame alliances coming in, as opposed to people like Andrew and Philip or Corinne and Dawn and, if you want to lump in Brandon there as well, I guess, who had been on seasons together before and therefore, you know, didn't really have to go through the same thing that the rest of them did when it came to grouping people together on day one, establishing new bonds with people. And I guess it's particularly bad in Corinne's case because she's not someone who really mixes in with the LA survivor oriented TV scene. And so because of that, it was more of an uphill battle for her than it would have been for some of these other people. Now, my criticism of her at the time was that, well, so she had the choice between going with them and going with the other people on her tribe who also were the only ones there from their season. So Brenda, Eric, and so on. And she chose to go with the pairs, which made me think that, well, her criticism becomes a lot less forceful because she had this choice of who to go with and she put herself in this situation. So I'm wondering, going back to the first episode now, do you think she, and I guess Malcolm, if the two really were as tight as it seems, do you think they made the right call in choosing that side, or is there maybe something there that we aren't seeing that's going into that decision?
I guess basically in a vacuum, it's probably they made the safer call in going with the people that knew each other, and thus they had more reason to believe that that was a group that could stick together, except now they're going to find out why, which is these people all know each other, and that could now, after we have all become safe and knocked out all the lone wolves, basically, now we're left with all these people who knew each other, and Corinne has taken out all the people that didn't in order to be there only with the people that do. Now, I don't think I would have done anything differently in her and Malcolm's spot. I think for that vote was the early game, generally speaking, especially in a tribe of 10, is hang back, let other people make big targets of themselves. If Francesca's the lock boot, I'm fine, honestly, again, because you know Philip's going to keep the target on himself throughout as long as he's there.
One way in which what Corinne said might make more sense is if it wasn't really her and Malcolm who were making that decision, so if somebody else or some other group of people with the swing votes. And I think the obvious candidates for that would be Corinne and Dawn, who it seemed like were generally in the middle, because from what we saw on the show and in her exit interviews, Francesca seemed to generally think that Corinne and Dawn were with her. And so I imagine there was some weight behind that assumption. It wasn't just the fact that she and Cochran knew each other vaguely in real life.
Right, exactly. And we saw when Francesca was bringing her whole coalition, like her attempted coalition together, Dawn was one of the ones who was always there when she was talking, trying to get people together. And then when they were counting out like all the votes they had for sure, I think she and Brenda had a scene talking through like, oh, well, we've got Andrea and we've got Dawn and Cochran and so forth. Because you're right. Yeah, I think Dawn and Andrea and Cochran, all three, were really the swing players, much more so than Corinne was.
So do you think it was like, because the three of them, them being Cochran, Andrea, and Dawn, kind of knew each other from outside the game, and because Cochran and Andrea at least had this tie with Francesca, that because it was them making the decision, everyone else felt kind of powerless? Like, well, our fates are going to be in the hands of Cochran and Andrea and Dawn, and that's only the case because the thing that happened before the game is like we didn't even have a chance to control our own destiny, if you like.
That's entirely fine, because I think that's definitely the general gist of her tweet, is this was an impossible situation if and when this goes poorly for me.
So I guess the next natural question then is, if it was in fact Cochran and Dawn who were in control this round, do you think they made the right decision then? I mean, I guess this is kind of informed by what we've seen after this, three episodes down the line, but at the same time, since they haven't had to go to tribal again, there hasn't really been anything that would change how we see that decision, I don't think. So with pretty much the same information we had back then, what more can we say about that move?
I'm still totally fine with it. I still think they swung to the right side, just because I feel like you can count on, of all people in Survivor history, Philip Shepherd to, first of all, stay loyal, and second of all, keep making kind of an ass out of himself, and someone who you could at least theoretically point to as someone that an entire group of people could get behind voting out, even if it may not be in their actual game best interest.
Yeah, I keep coming back to this rift, which seems to be their own making, between Andrew and Francesca. Because you would have expected that the two of them would have been in alliance for sure, and presumably Cochran and Dawn as well, going back to our pre-show predictions, but you would have thought those were at least. So when it comes down to the fact that it is going to be one of the two of them, and the people in the middle have to decide which of them to go with, I feel like at that point, you know, that you have to reevaluate how you see each of them, because like we were saying pre-show that someone like Andrew is going to be a good ally, but if you're in a spot where she is now turning on someone who you would have expected to be her tightest ally this early, is that really a safe assumption to make anymore?
Well, that's why I've been thinking and said when Francesca got voted out again, that in her attempt to make sure that she was not to do everything in her power to make sure that she was not the first one to get voted out again, Francesca basically ensured for herself that she was going to be the first one voted out again. Well, yes, I would be absolutely skittish that Andrea was suddenly willing to turn on someone that I certainly would have expected her, that I knew to be her friend in real life, and a presumed ally within the game, that this first tribal council, she's trying her hardest to get her gone. Yes, that would make me nervous, but I feel like were I also out there, I would simultaneously be seeing why it was that Francesca was getting that kind of response from Andrea.
Okay, that's interesting, because I feel like if Governor John had gone with Francesca, then Francesca wouldn't have gotten into the mindset that she needed to scramble furiously to avoid getting voted out, and therefore she wouldn't have had to go after Andrea at all, and like, if they had just voted out Philip, I assume Andrea, I don't think she would have been happy with it, but I think she would understand why it had to happen, right? Because Andrea is someone who lived with Philip for, what, 37 days? She knows him better than the others, and having been there, she understands just how grating he can be on the people who have only just met him for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, Francesca and Andrea, maybe what happened was inevitable, but it could have at least been delayed for a long time. And so you keep them there in the same group with you. You can play off that tension when you need to later down the road. And for the time being, like, it's better to have them around because you have ties with each of them. They are kind of aware of each other. And also, like, those other people in the alliance, the Erics and Brandons and Brendas of the world, they're less close to Francesca than you now are, given that, you know, if you're a Culkin, you know her in real life. So I just don't see any downside to starting with Francesca there. Although, again, given how weird the editing's been this season, it's possible this is just based off a lot of stuff which doesn't reflect what's going on out there.
See, I generally don't get down with this kind of, like, Kurt Vonnegut school of thought of whatever the result that did happen was the only one that could have ever conceivably happened because it did, in fact, happen. Which is roughly the same logic I'm using here on this Francesca boot, which is, I agree with you that if there had been a better opportunity, I think enough of these people would have recognized it and taken it and gone with it. And the fact that because Francesca and Andrea, that did come to such loggerheads so early, that was the only way it could have ever played out. And thus, that decision had to be made and that conclusion had to be come to, because that was the conclusion that they came to.
Okay, I can see that. So the first thing we see this episode is the standard post-trouble council recrimination scene where they get back that night and usually there's some kind of fallout and there's no change from that here. So the first thing we see is Sherry losing her cool, and this is something which we're not really used to. She's been poised and composed so far, just seemed to be in control of everything that's gone on. And the outcome of tribal council isn't something we should have faced at all, but there seems to be... She seems to have let herself get involved in the arguments around camp.
Mm-hmm. This was definitely interesting for me as well, because I think it was Eddie kind of antagonizing her and talking about, like, well, if Laura's the weakest one, then why is she still here? Because, you know, you said that. She's like, yes, I did say that. Like, kind of losing her mind. And it must – one of two things is happening here. Either Eddie was just badgering her relentlessly for, like, hours on end, and she finally just cracked, or – there's more to Sherry or Sherry's been getting, with that scene as an exception, a very positive edit from that point, or from this point through there.
Yeah, it's possible this has happened before and they just hit it until now. My first thought at the time was that maybe she was just being protective of Laura. She was interpreting what Eddie said as an attack on Laura and by extension, I guess, on her, and she was just overreacting to that.
It's also possible that she didn't think that what she was doing came read to a camera nearly to the degree that it did.
What do you mean by that?
Like, she wasn't meaning to be as intense as it came across. Like, she was just kind of like, yes, I did, in fact, say that. Maybe that's a thin justification. I don't know. But this is, I think it's, this whole scene, I think, is very much, when we you know, because the fans are, spoiler alert, going to lose this immunity again. And when we talk about the decision-making that goes into that vote, this scene is something that I think plays a big role in that. You know, this fallout after the last tribal council where Reynolds goes on to say something, to quote, "I don't want to be associated with you. I have no respect for any of you. I have absolutely no respect for any of you, so far as said. And so this is obviously setting things off in kind of a tense tone at the fans camp, and that's not something that's going to change for a while. Is Sherry really your big focus here? Because for me it was more Reynolds and Eddie are out at this point.
Yeah, Sherry's my focus because this is something which we hadn't seen before, and which I don't think we would have expected to see. Whereas for Reynolds and Eddie, this is just variations on the theme here. Like, they're riffing on stuff which they said last week and the week before. and this is nothing new from them, so it just seemed less noteworthy.
Right, this is the third episode in a row to start with Reynold and Eddie not waking up, but coming back from tribal council going, what the hell, everyone betrayed me.
Right, but their reaction to that is important because I think it plays into the decision that Matt and Michael end up making later, where they have to basically evaluate if they keep Reynold and Eddie, are the two of them going to stay loyal? And it seems from the statements which the two of them have publicly made that, like, they understand that if they are being kept around, it's for convenience sake, for their worth and challenges, and not because anyone actually feels any degree of loyalty to them.
Right.
And that presumably, therefore, the first time they get an opportunity, they're going to jump off the sinking ship.
Right, and that is, I mean, we could just get it right out of the way right now, Dom. I think this was an insane boot.
Yeah, and not insane in the way that the gamers have described it as in, oh, that's sick, that was awesome, but as in, this was legitimately insane. I just don't understand their thought process.
Right.
I understand it, but it just seems so obviously wrong that, you know, either we're not seeing something or they're not seeing something. It has to be one of the two.
Mm. I mean, we'll definitely be getting there in due course. Now, I think if we're good, let's jump over to the favorites camp for a little bit, where Philip Shepherd, who we, you know, I got to say first right off the bat, actually, I've been very impressed with Philip overall this season. Like, obviously his shtick is not necessarily what I'm always interested in, but I think generally speaking, he's been absolutely crushing it as a player. And this is, we hear him give a confessional describing how his new plan for the morning is to go around giving nicknames to everyone else as part of like a strategic move where to make these people feel like they're part of the team. And so it means Brandon's going to get a nickname and Eric's going to get a nickname. And hey, maybe even Brenda's going to get a nickname too. So he goes and gives Brandon his nickname, the Conqueror, because he does so well in the challenges. Eric is quite fittingly the Silent One within Stealth R Us. And then at this point, Andrea is very, very displeased with this whole chain of events where it used to be okay for people to get the kind of this cartoonish nickname. But now everyone's getting a nickname, and what makes no one special anymore? I mean, what's next? Brenda getting a nickname? And as luck would have it, you guessed it, Brenda gets a nickname, and that nickname is Serenity. But more importantly, Dom, Brenda gets her first scene of the season. What are we thinking?
Yeah, Brenda's actually there. I was overjoyed, clearly, but she didn't even get any kind of insight about it. Like, no confessional saying that she understands what Philip's doing or her laughing at Philip or anything like that. It's just she's there as a plot device, basically.
Right. It's like, hey, you, this person so far down the totem pole that even you, the idea of you getting a nickname is crazy. Here's your nickname. And she's like, oh, really? And that's basically it.
Right. It's like she's there as a prop to explain why Andrew's spazzing out again.
Right.
And it doesn't really serve any purpose beyond that.
So, I mean, I can't imagine there's going to be a ton of Brenda discussion coming up. So, quickly, how are you feeling about this so far?
Well, hopefully we'll have a long time in the future to talk about Brenda. But in any case, for now, I'm curious why you're so impressed with Philip. Because, like, I don't think this is something which is working for his allies or for the people who aren't currently his allies. Like, we saw Andrea get jealous of, or whatever you want to call it, about this in the way that Andrea seems prone to do. But I feel like everyone else also has to realize that Philip giving people nicknames, sure, it's cute and harmless when it's done to the people within Stealth of Us, but when it loses its exclusivity and it's being done to everybody, then it, like, the rationale behind it just seems to disappear. Like, it's no longer a symbol that Philip values you, it's just something which he does to everybody for undisclosed reasons.
I feel like if I got one of the nicknames in the original Stealth R Us 2.0, not Ometepe Stealth R Us, but this Stealth R Us, where it was made clear to me, and we were the six that ended up voting together, and now these people are on the outs, and Philip, as, you know, wacky or whatever word you want to use as he is still a guy who's played Survivor before and kind of knows the game, sort of. And we can all at least be familiar with the fans versus favorites format, considering we all knew we were going to be out here playing. Point being, we know a swap's coming up. I'm endorsing this move to further contradict your point. I'm outright endorsing this move to get these people as best we can on our sides in the event that we keep banging off these challenges and swap. And because if we can just pick off the fans, come swap and merge and get back down, then what's to stop the original Stealth R Us from just running the table there?
Well, see, I don't see this as a move, and I can understand why you would endorse the idea behind it, but at the same time, I don't think it's working well enough for you to be able to do that. Like, I don't think Eric and Brandon and Brenda are under any illusions that Philip actually values him anymore now because he's given them a nickname. Like, Eric and Brandon specifically had secret scenes where they said that this was just Philip doing Philip things, going through the motions, and that it wasn't something that they could take any comfort in. And similarly with Brenda, obviously didn't get a secret scene because why would she? But I think even she understands that while at the time she was smiling sweetly and putting on a fake laugh or whatever, this really isn't something which bodes well for her long term any more than anything else does.
No, and I think you're certainly right. And maybe the point, I guess if that is the case, then the point I would have more against it is I would endorse it if I thought it would work. If it's not going to work and if it's just going to come off as patronizing, then it's not the call. And given that that's the reaction, I guess then I will concede the point, then yes.
But I feel like it's just automatically not going to work. Like, the general idea of playing nice with the people outside your group in order to make them less likely to flip or whatever, that's just a basic thing which everyone should be on board with. But when it's Philip giving people stuff that are nicknames, automatically you have reason to doubt whether this is going to be effective or not. And I don't think any of us would be surprised that nobody was convinced by this.
No, that's true. But I feel like, again, if I was in a spot within Stealth or Us or otherwise, where if I'm thinking long term, I'm going to need to break this up at some point, and I'm probably going to need some people that weren't in Stealth R Us to do that, be they, I've heard it both ways, fans or favorites that were on the outs initially, I'm going to need some anti-Philip sentiment, I think, and him giving these goofy nicknames and doing stupid Philip things all the time is definitely good for business on that front.
Can you explain that? Because I don't think this is something which Philip is, I mean, obviously he is consciously giving people nicknames, but I don't think there's any complex thought process behind it.
No, but I feel like people have distinct reactions to it, and if I'm like Malcolm or Cochran, where I'm not necessarily planning on sticking with this the whole way, Philip giving everyone a nickname and doing these crazy Philip things could potentially be used down the line as some reason to turn the tables.
Right, but this whole line of conversation sprang from you saying that you were impressed by Philip, and now you seem to be making the argument that this is great for everyone else except Philip because now it gives people a reason to turn on him.
Okay, I meant I'm impressed, generally speaking, not with this specifically, where you're right, this is probably one of the, if not the weaker points of his season, is strategically, given that that is how people responded. But I like that he's thinking on, like, he's showing me something by saying, I'm going to strategically try to make these people feel better. Now, the end result of that didn't turn out the way that he was necessarily hoping. But I still I've been impressed with Philip's ability to build this alliance, maintain this alliance, and at least try to be thinking about how to work with the people who aren't in that primary group, because that was never something we saw out of him before.
You're giving him points for effort then?
I guess. I see that he's trying and that thought is getting put into this, and some things are going right for him. It's not like he's completely O for everything.
I guess we'll have to wait and see. In any case, I'm sure there'll be a lot more Philip to discuss later and in future episodes. So I think the next thing to get on to is the immunity challenge. Now, Cochran gets to sit out for the first time ever, and I'm glad for the guy. I'm glad that he gets to live one of his dreams. But at the same time, the fact that he has to be this overjoyed about sitting out of a challenge is, I think he's not getting the full survivor experience, let's say.
Not to instantly start shitting all over all of your points, because I'm totally on board about Cochran. Dumb. This is a reward challenge. This is not a combined challenge. This is Cochran's going to be sitting this one out so he can save all of his strength for the key holding role in the actual immunity challenge. But yeah,
Oh, is that it? Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly why.
Right. I really hope Cochran just proves us all wrong and goes on some freakish immunity run post merge now.
I'll take the under. But yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying that this will happen. I'm expressing hope.
Yeah. So as mentioned, this is a reward challenge, and this is very similar to the one in Fans versus Favorites, one of my favorite all-time Survivor moments, when James Clement recognized that they had to carry people across on alternating poles, and he realized he could just carry Eliza at the top of the pole and just walk from platform to platform by himself. And so it's very similar to that, although the caveat has been added this time, and while also they're not on poles, they're on just little planks, but Probst points out that you cannot move with the person. You are just a step for them to the eyes. So you can't do what James did, basically.
Right. I always like it when someone manages to outthink the challenge or gain the challenge. And I like it especially much when it's not because there's somebody smart, like, deconstructing a way to get through the challenge in some with some fast route or whatever. It's just some big bulky guy just walking through the water with carrying a pole. Like, it's a triumph of brawn over brain, basically.
Right. When people think historically about James, and this was always the impression, there are two challenges that I can think back to that were just clearly designed for him. But all other challenges, he's just like a regular player. The other one, this pole one being one, another one being in China where they were on like two different boats and the only goal was to shove people off the platforms. Like, who could ever get James down before he could get you?
Oh, well, also the one where they had to swing the mace and hit the targets off the poles.
Is that?
But James was a complete beast at that.
Was he particularly good at that? Didn't everyone?
Yeah, he was.
Oh, okay.
I think there was one heat where he swung the mace and hit two of the things at the same time.
I feel like Jamie did that too, though.
Maybe that challenge was awesome, by the way. I hope we see that. I mean, obviously, it was kind of a theme challenge, so we can't really see it just as a generic thing, but. It would make a nice change from all of these carnival games, at least.
Philippines is a pretty cool call. I mean, I don't know that, actually. I don't know anything about the Philippines. I just found out how to spell it correctly. But it seems like they could be incorporating more cultural stuff. Although, winner of this reward challenge, speaking of cultural Philippines stuff, gets a visit to their camp from Tata the Bushman. Before we get to Tata, I definitely do want to point out, end result of the challenge, the favorites win, and Shamar starts celebrating. This was like the finally Shamar, a solid Shamar payoff before not much more coming out of Shamar, spoiler alert again.
Yeah, I like the irony of the guy who came into the game saying he was going to do everything to make his own team's life living hell, unintentionally managing to celebrate his team losing a challenge.
So let's head over here now back to the fans camp, because this is a pretty critical moment that's about to happen. I hit a little bit on it earlier, which is Shamar, over the course of the season, this is nothing new, he's just apparently been, you know, hanging out in camp 19 hours a day, just underneath the shelter, a lot of sleeping, he's demanding, he's not going to quit, but only if people go and bring him some rice. And I actually, like, there was literally a shot of him walking out to meet them to bring him his rice, but he was unwilling to go the extra 10 feet to go sit and eat his rice with everyone else. So obviously this game's not going as planned for Shamar, and he's not feeling too great about pretty much anything. And to top it all off, some sand gets in his eye, and then there's a bad storm that night, and the tribe's talking about, oh my god, you know, Shamar's been horrible, and now it's looking like he's probably going to want to quit. And his eyes, apparently, you know, it's not going away. He may have scratched a cornea or something. Jeff comes in with the doctors, and out of nowhere, Dom, I didn't see this coming at all, we have lost our biggest character through, you know, percentage-wise through the first few episodes, that being Shamar. And this Shamar ends up getting medevaced. Now, this is the second time. We saw it once with Colton and now with Shamar, where this medevac edit has just absolutely blown me away.
I don't think it's right to call it a medevac edit necessarily, because we've seen people get medevac before who just basically weren't really there up until that point. I think it's mainly a function of how big those characters were, and it just happened to be them who got medevaced. I think the Colton comparison is interesting, though, because the two of them are just so diametrically opposed. Like, if the two of them met in real life, or, God forbid, on a Survivor season, it wouldn't be pretty to watch.
Yeah, oh my god. People complaining about casting would go ballistic for that. No, you're right. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, actually, about this is not an intentionally crafted medevac edit to make the person just larger than life only to instantly rob them of us. This just happens to be a function of Colton and Shamar being who they are.
I feel like this is a case of a more general trend where people assign qualities to people who have had big edits because, naturally, because they've had big edits, we're likely to remember them more. For instance, like when Dana was medevac last season, I didn't hear people saying that Dana got the classic medevac edit, even though I imagine hers was probably more indicative of the average medevac edit than like Shamar's or Colton's would have been.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I mean, we've had so many people fucking medevac at this point that there's no real quintessential medevac edit. I don't think. There are just some people are interesting and some people are boring, and a random distribution of people get medevaced. That's the end of the line there. Now, the thing for me was, back to Shamar specifically, this dude, as brought up from time to time, was a Marine. And I said in the pre-show analysis thing, I thought that the conditions out there were going to be absolute cake for him. I thought he was going to have no problems whatsoever surviving. I thought he was going to be like a leader on his team, teaching all the other people how to thrive in the environment. And that was just so far from the case, to the point that I am, like, pretty upset that he was even deemed island-worthy in the first place, given what seemed to be a pretty severe case of PTSD at best.
So, are you upset because of his clear mental health problems, or because of the dishonor he brought to the U.S. Marine Corps?
The former, for sure. I stand firmly intact about the U.S. Marine Corps. Dom, don't fuck with them, because we have a fucking nuclear warhead with your name on it, buddy.
Because, like, to listen to what you said, like, Shamar could have been sat there being waterboarded by sand, and he'd have just been able to power through it through the sheer force of willpower.
That's what I was thinking. I was, legitimately, like, this guy's training must have been so intense, but, and maybe it's just I have a massive misconception, but I really don't believe that that's the case. I've read a lot of writing from actual Marines about what they go through.
So it turns out nobody else agreed with your opinion that if there was a U.S. Marine out there, you can't vote them out because, fuck, they're a U.S. Marine.
I would say, no. I said I would never vote them out first, and first he was not voted out. But the standard U.S. Marine to me is the Mike Chisel type, who, by the way, was a U.S. Marine. The bottom line for me is nothing gets removed from the U.S. Marine Corps from me. I can't believe Shamar was a Marine. That's the bottom line for me.
I mean, do you think that he was like a stable personality before he went out there, and what he went through in Iraq just changed him fundamentally, or is it something more long lasting, do you think?
I mean, I'm sure he wasn't always to the same degree of kind of like explosiveness and quickness to lose his temper. Or emotional vulnerability. I'm sure, obviously, and again, of course, we could never know anything like what it would be like. But I think there were always at least kind of like seeds of it.
I think I see what you're getting at, but I mean, as tempting as it is to conclude that, well, this is something a lot more deep seated with Shamar, that you know, he was like this long before he joined the Marines, and it just like exacerbated the worst aspects of his personality. Given the proportion of Marines that end up with these mental health problems or end up homeless and things like that, I'm kind of inclined to think that it's just such a life altering experience that it can change pretty normal people in the most drastic of ways, and that, you know, maybe it's a function of the type of people who joined the Marines in the first place that they're more susceptible to this type of treatment, if you like. But I don't know. It's something which we're not really qualified to speculate on, I don't think.
Right, yeah, and I'd definitely have to look up statistics, and I don't know that it would be specific necessarily to Marines versus other branches, but yeah. No, we basically don't know. I'd have to read more into it, I guess.
Yeah, well, one thing to mention about this, actually, is that Shamar said in one of his interviews that he actually had two injuries that were giving him trouble at this point. He had the eye injury, which turned out to be something pretty minor, like they looked at it and dealt with it pretty quickly. But the other was an injury to his hand, which it didn't really show, and that's the one which is leaving more permanent damage. Like, he still hasn't recovered from that, I don't think. And you could kind of see it in the episode where, as he's laying back, one of his hands is just lying on his body as usual, and then the other one is, like, stuck, mounted in the air, as if he doesn't want to touch with anything else or get anything in it or anything like that.
See, this is... I doubled around here on conspiracy theory of the week, where my first theory was Shamar got medevaced, like, as kind of a cop-out, where they said, we'll give you a legitimate reason to leave the game rather than I just am done and fed up and I want to, so you don't look like a quitter. I'm now thinking that was the message they wanted to send, where right, to make Shamar look like as big of a pussy as possible, when in fact, there were legitimate reasons for him to get taken out.
Although, I'm surprised that they didn't handle Colton's edit in the same way then, because I feel like they could have made his appendix injury, given that it's something which was completely invisible, right, it was like there's no obvious sign that there was something wrong with him other than Colton like screaming in pain or whatever. I feel like they could have portrayed that in such a way to give us even less sympathy for Colton.
I feel like that's a tall order less sympathy for Colton is a tall order, but an appendix bursting is no joke, and pretty much I don't know how you can really spin that. Given that there's, like, if you're going to point to something else, like you mentioned, it's entirely internal. You can't really point to anything else.
Didn't Colton say himself that it wasn't actually his appendix? It was some, I can't remember the name of it, but some other stomach injury.
I don't know. And I also feel like with Colton's thing, the fact that it was entirely internal, they wanted that there to be some aspect of this guy had it coming and this was a natural consequence of the way he behaved.
Right, and also I think they want to protect the show from the perception that, oh, well, if somebody's having a bad day, they can just, like, lie down on their back and scream for a bit, and somebody will take them out, and it'll be classed as a medevac and not just them quitting.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think that given that one of the premises of the show is that this isn't just a weird social experiment, it's something which is taking place in these incredibly harsh conditions, that when somebody gets injured, showing the full extent of that injury really brings home to people just how real this that aspect of the show actually is.
Oh, yeah. So, oh, sorry, go ahead.
They don't really want to underplay somebody's injury if it's something which is actually causing them legitimate pain to the extent that they need to be taken out.
Oh, totally, yeah. And I think in thinking back just, like, about the genesis of the show and how it caught on, a big part of the popularity was people like, oh, my God, these people actually have to survive and someone could die out on that island.
I remember, like, hearing that at the time, some of the hype around the show was, well, are they actually going to let people die out there? And then people tuned in, and it turned out to be this weird game with all these complicated rules and stuff, and some people got bored and tuned out, but apparently enough people liked it that it's still on the air now, so...
When I first, I think I've told this story once, when I first heard about Survivor, I was very much not interested in tuning in. I thought all of this new reality TV thing was a fad for the dumb masses of America, and I thought it was literally going to be, however many people are going to be on an island, one of them is going to live, and that person's going to be the survivor, and all these people are going to be like, and maybe that's the future. We should have brought this up with Max, the future of reality television. Like, if we're going to have to keep pushing the envelope, we may eventually see a game where all the participants but one literally die for a shot at, like, $5 billion, some, like, infinite amount of money.
You want to have, like, a real-life Hunger Games or Battle Royale?
I feel like I've seen enough that I'm going to be... My senses can never be piqued again. I've desensitized myself to the point that I require blood to feel any real actual emotion about anyone getting eliminated from a show.
See, I want to make fun of you for that, but I feel like that is actually like a sentiment that's held among a lot of the viewing audience.
Oh, yeah, and it's a very, very real sentiment. All right, I think if you're good, let's move on to this week's hashtag immunity challenge. And you guessed it, Dom, it is 10 minutes of some kind of weird... physical thing followed, played with the purposes of someone getting a 1 to 3 minute head start on whatever outcome determined carnival game of the week they have selected. The first part was yet another thing from the initial fans versus favorites, which, and again, hey, apparently Eric's got home field advantage or home format advantage here, as in having played all these challenges before. And the second part was yet another weird, this week they went with the throwing baseballs at the pile of milk bottles.
Yeah, I'm wondering if, like, back in high school or something, one of the challenge producers was traumatized by some kind of ring toss game, and they're now trying to get past that by, like, making other people live it out or something. I don't know, it's weird, because, firstly, on All-Star Seasons in general, one of the things they like to do is say, well, we're going to bring back some of your favorite challenges from past seasons. Now, this hasn't always been successful. Like, in Heroes vs. Villains, one of the hits was Survivor Bowling. So their definition of an All-Star challenge is maybe a bit looser than ours, but I feel like if you're going to be going to such an extent to hype this season, given like what you know about it, you can at least make an effort to make the challenges worthwhile as well.
Mm-hmm. See, I don't hate the challenge. I mean, I hate the way that every challenge now comes down to who's better at the buzzword for it now, or these carnival games. Where my question really, I guess, at the end of the day is why now? Why is this suddenly the thing? Because they're, you know. When Boston Rob was in Redemption Island, that's when they started going so hard on these puzzles at the end of these challenges, and there was speculation about that. Given, you know, we've seen Malcolm not be able to struggle with that, so clearly it's not an intent to further his game. There was some speculation that it was because Reynolds has proven to be quite skilled with these drinking games for Sunday afternoon out on the lawn. That perhaps they were trying to keep working these in to maybe get the fans a chance to win a couple of these challenges. Do you have any thoughts about why this has become such a hot thing to do?
Well, I don't know about those conspiracy theories necessarily, but stepping outside of those for a moment, I can understand if their rationale was, well, our budget's tight, so we need to cut back on some of these more complicated challenges. But I would have thought that, firstly, these kind of multi-stage, swim out to the water, climb this tall platform, swim back, toss the ring games, firstly, aren't that easy to build, and secondly, there are games that are easy to build which would have been far more compelling. Like, you think back to Cook Islands, where they had that challenge where everyone from each team was tied together in a row, and they had to run around until one team caught the other, which, you know, pretty standard game that everyone can recognize. Very easy to build, pretty much doesn't cost anything at all, but it's a good, like, it's a fun challenge to watch, makes a good viewing experience. Similarly with, like, the weight challenge I had in South Pacific and various other seasons, where it's just people hold weights until everyone drops the weight and then it's over, like, last one standing wins. Again, it's a very simple concept, something which people enjoy watching, and it's very easy to do. So, given that there are lots of challenges like that, I'm not sure why they feel the need to go back to this weird formula.
Well, I feel like, considering all-time weight-bearing record holder Brandon Hance is there, it wouldn't really be fair but to do that one specifically. But no, you're right. And I feel like we could, that maybe that could be a good challenge that we could see, like, as soon as this next episode. I think that is someone, or that is one that they make, that is, like, a classic Survivor challenge. That one, a variation of that was in Season 2, that epic one between Colby and Mike Scupin. So, immunity challenge, not too much to get into. The favorites end up winning. You know, Shep brings it home. Malcolm's still 0 for career in Carnival Games, but he's at least doing well in the other aspects of the challenges. The fans now have to go vote someone out, and because Shamar got medevaced before they had already lost immunity, he is not going to be there to take the bullet. And this, so the factors that I think the fans really need to be considering here are a swap coming up soon, a swap not coming up soon, loyalty if either of those things happens, and strength if they don't. And also Reynolds hidden immunity idol. So Dom, I think actually the first place I want to start is Matt goes up to Reynolds quite quickly and says, "I want to vote Laura out." And Reynolds thinks this is another lie from Matt. And this is, you know, you referenced it earlier and gave me a hard time about it, about me comparing Matt to Chris Doherty. I thought this was another perfect example of exactly what Chris Doherty would do. And I will vehemently defend that comparison. And I feel like he is playing exactly the same game.
How so? Like, the thing we remember about Chris is that he was very good at smoothing over his life to people after the fact. And you can say, oh, well, this is just a general thing to do. Like, after you've lied with someone, try and make nice with them afterwards. And then you're, like, trying to extend that to say, well, because Chris did it, and Matt's trying to do it now, but therefore there must be some kind of similarity between them. Whereas, in fact, it's that Chris not only did it, but did it very well, and I don't see any evidence that Matt's very successful at it.
See, I think this next coming episode is going to be, I will remove it from the table if Matt does not take the angle now with Reynolds and Eddie of, oh, the reason we voted Laura out, we were totally with you, and this was a sign to show our loyalty to you. If they go outright, oh, it was just to keep strength, then I'm absolutely with you. If he spins it like this was a deliberate effort for the sake of Reynolds and Eddie, then I will continue to stand by it.
Sure, but even if he is that good at it, it may be that ship has already sailed. Like, it may be that this one act is enough to redeem them in the eyes of Eddie and Reynolds.
No, and you're right, and I'm not even beginning to say that it's going to have the same outcome that it had for Chris Doherty. I feel like the thought process and they speak very similarly, too. I feel like they have similar accents. And they both seem to be,
what does that have to do with anything?
It reminds me of Chris Doherty when he talks. Like, when you talk, I'm immediately reminded of Ace. There's nothing I can do about it. I'm sorry. I mean all of this about Matt in a very good way. I want to be clear.
I can tell that you mean all of it about Matt in a very good way. I'm just not sure that confidence is warranted.
Okay, I think this next coming episode is going to be a big deciding factor. So maybe this is a conversation we should have then.
Okay, fair.
All right. So speaking a little bit more about Matt, I guess, he pitches booting Laura to Sherry, and Sherry is someone that we've seen have a great deal of influence over this tribe, at least as it pertained to keeping Shamar around for their, you know, until he got medevaced or whatever happened. And he's pitching Laura now, booting Laura to Sherry, and Sherry is not on board with this by any means, and I think this is very telling, Dom, that Matt and Mike, and granted, because there are now only seven people, it only takes Matt and Mike wanting to flip it if they are so inclined. There's nothing Laura or Sherry or Julia can do about it. But I still feel like this is very telling. Like, this was the time that Sherry went along with someone else's plan. That, like, this scene was included to show that Sherry was not on board with this.
I imagine what happened is that Matt and Michael approached her with this plan. She tried to talk them out of it, but it quickly became clear that they were set on doing this. And at that point, I think Sherry realized that, well, casting a vote against these other three isn't really going to accomplish anything. We may as well give the appearance of being a unified tribe by having me and Julia boot Laura as well, given that this seemed to be the predetermined outcome.
Mm-hmm. Right, no, exactly, and I think this, and that's why I'm feeling like there's probably going to, they set the votes up to be there, to sell to Reynolds and Eddie, hey, we were all on board with keeping you.
I don't know if that's necessarily true, though, because let's say you're Eddie or Reynolds, I don't think it really matters which one. If you see Michael and Matt flip over to you, and the four of you vote against the people you see as the other three now, the three women, then I feel like that's much more likely to convince you that, you know, you found some new allies, you're now in a new alliance, than it is if the whole tribe agrees to boot Laura, and now, presumably next week is going to be business as usual, and they're going to boot one of you.
See, I feel like the end goal here is not long-term safety for Reynolds and Eddie. It is long-term safety for you and probably Laura. I'd rather be playing the goal is keeping the fans unified as possible come swap time, and then hopefully whoever's left there at the come merge time. It's not looking like we're going to have numbers, but we do want to stay unified and hopefully find some favorites to flip or something, make something happen. I'm not trying for there to be cracks then, which I think a 4-3 vote. I certainly agree with you that it would make him feel better about his bonds with Matt and Mike, but I want, if I'm Matt and Mike, I want him feeling better about his bonds with Sherry and Julia too.
Okay, that's fine. I'm thinking of the same principle that Albert mentioned when he did an interview with us where he said that at the Michaela boot, it was like everyone knew that Michaela was going home that night. Nobody's under any illusions about that. But they wanted to make it a 4-3 vote so that if she did come back into the game via Redemption Island, she would at least be more likely to think that she could find a way back in there. And obviously, it's a little different this time because it's not about Redemption Island, it's about fear of an impending swap. But I think the same idea still applies.
See, I feel like that's a situation, like you're voting someone out knowingly and trying to make them still feel okay with you. In this case, you're keeping someone in, which should, like you're already doing half the battle, and now when they see the vote go unanimously, I feel like that's going to be a better selling point for them. Like we all wanted this.
Well, I think they're going to naturally have to think, if this happens again, we lose another challenge. Are Matt and Michael still going to stick with us, or are they just going to go right back to Sherry and Julia? And all else being equal, I would have assumed, given that the dividing lines now are pretty muddy if you're Eddie and Reynolds, that they would just go back to Sherry and Julia. You might think, well, if they still think they need some challenges, then they might just boot Julia or something instead. But if it's clear to find 4-3, then they're much more likely to think that this is a permanent switch rather than just a temporary arrangement.
No, and I definitely see why you're saying that, but I feel like that would then, again, just be specific to Matt and Mike, and it's going to be different. Like, I'd have to swap pretty perfectly for that to come into play for helpfulness, whereas if the play is going to work in any case, then any swap is fine for me in this variation.
But we're discussing it through the eyes of Michael and Matt because it seems like they're the ones who had to make the call this week.
Mm-hmm. It
doesn't really make sense to talk about what's most important for Julia or Sherry when it's those two that seem to be in the middle here.
Okay, see, I then would not even be considering having Sherry and Julia put their votes still on there, or still put their votes on Reynolds or Eddie, whoever, because I feel like if they were to, they wouldn't do that knowingly, and I do not at all want to blindside them with this vote.
Right, it might be that it's impossible to coordinate this vote in such a way that they're not more suspicious of you than they were before. But I feel like even broaching this idea with them is going to make them at least a little bit suspicious. Like because they're going to have to think, and Shay brought up this point herself very astutely, well, their definition of strong seems to involve being male, right? So if this situation comes up again and they're still concerned about strength, they're not going to go after Reynolds or Eddie. They're going to go after either me or Julia.
Mm-hmm. See, I feel like you can sell to Sherry that you would not do that, and you can sell to Reynolds and Eddie that you would do that. And so if we're thinking for Matt and Mike, I think the 6-1 vote while keeping them in, if you're going to insist on Laura going, 6-1's the way to do it.
Okay, so we talked about the execution of the idea, if you want to go through with it. I think the more important question, though, is whether it's a good idea in the first place. And I know you have some pretty strong thoughts about that.
Right, and those thoughts, as we touched on earlier, are this is absolutely not a good idea to go through with in the first place. From my perspective, I would... This is lunacy to me. This is absolutely, this is, especially given that I think one of the big reasons I say that is the fact that Reynolds did in fact play his idol when he, after the votes were cast to Tribal Council, signaling he, even after the votes, the plan worked, the votes were put in, he granted didn't see the result yet, but he was not, he did not know that this was definitely going to happen, or he would have sat on that idol.
Well, I don't think that's a good argument, because as you say, he hadn't seen the results yet. Like, I think he was 100% playing that idol no matter what anybody said to him that round.
Okay, maybe that's true, but I feel still like...
And as Eddie said at the end, like the main determinant of how they were going to feel about it is if they were still here after the votes were read this week. And both of them said, "Ah," which, you know, maybe suggests that they're going to feel a bit happy about their place now. I think, like, if you look at the arguments that people have made in favor of doing this and that Matt and Michael seem to have used, like, the first one was that Laura is, you know, Laura's physically weak, Reynold and Eddie are strong, you know, the obvious first level thinking. I could maybe sympathize with that a bit more if we didn't have good reason to think that there's going to be a swap, not only in the near future, but in the very next episode.
Okay. I think the thing is, we would know that the total number of players left after this vote would be odd.
That's a good point, actually. How do you think that's going to affect things? Because, again, if this happened in your production, you see somebody get pulled out the moment before you were going to switch the tribes up, and now, presumably, if you don't want to switch them up, add an odd number, you're left with a bit of a conundrum, because, like, do you just wait another round, or do you try to swap them in some new way, or what do you do?
See, I think after Shamar goes down, that means there are then an even number of people left. If they were planning on doing it after the next boot, which Shamar just advanced the progress of, once they show up to that next immunity challenge, they redraw for tribes, otherwise they're going to wait another two rounds. Basically put, I think... One person's going to get removed in this next episode, this big Brandon Hans episode. I don't know if it's going to be Brandon or not, but we're going to see one person removed, and then the week after that, we're going to have a swap.
Okay, although I feel like that might actually make me, if I'm Mad Michael, more likely to want to boot Reynold and Eddie, because if you're thinking about challenge strength versus loyalty, which is this age-old decision in Survivor that seems like people have to make every single season, like thinking long-term, if you know that there are going to be another three or four immunity challenges before a swap, then that weights the decision quite heavily in favor of strength, right? Because you need people to be strong in each of those three or four challenges. If there's only going to be another one or two challenges, though, then I think you might be able to afford to take that risk and just keep the less strong person, particularly because, as we said, if they lose this next challenge despite keeping Reynold and Eddie, now they're in this really difficult position because no matter who they vote out, they're going to leave at least one person mad at them, either whichever of Sherry and Junior is left or whichever of Reynold and Eddie is left. Whereas if they vote out Eddie this round, then next round, if they do lose again, well, they can just put out Reynold, go into a swap with a strong alliance of five people, and take it from there.
If we had voted out, if we, being Matt and Michael, voted out Eddie or Reynold this round, and assuming Reynold played his idol and we got Eddie out, I guess, I would probably go and throw the next challenge. Just to get it.
Yeah.
Whatever we did, whoever, if we've isolated someone, whatever line we've taken, and we haven't swapped yet, I'm throwing the challenge, knowing full, like, I'm happy to go into a swap down in numbers, given that that's going to happen anyway. I don't want there to be any wild cards with an axe to grind with me getting an opportunity.
Right, because if you've lost this challenge thinking that there's going to be at least one more challenge before a potential swap, that might actually be the worst possible position to be in, because if you're going to boot out Laura, you don't really have any good options now.
Mm-hmm. Although, I agree entirely, but if you have to go to exactly one more tribal council, you will invariably isolate someone for the swap.
Unless you throw that challenge to boot out the remaining person, which is possible if there were two people on the outside, i.e. Ed and Reynold, but not possible if there are three. So Laura, I guess if Laura's gone, then it would be Julia and Sherry.
Right, which my point is, as things currently stand, what they want either an even number or zero. They don't want...
Right. So it turns out then that this might actually be the worst possible scenario for them if this is actually going to happen.
Yeah. This could, if they lose this next challenge and round after that is a swap, then yes, this is absolutely the worst case scenario.
Right. The other argument I've heard in favor of beating Laura is that long term, it seems like Laura is going to be closer to Julia and Sherry than she is to the two of you. Within that five, it seems like it's three to do against you, if you like. And so down the road, when you get to final five or whatever, if this alliance remains intact, then the three girls are just going to boot the two guys and it's a simple road from there. So if you're Matt and Michael, you'd have to split things up a bit earlier, at which point, you know, it gets complicated because you have these two outsiders lying around and it just becomes very messy. Whereas this way, if you boot out one of the girls now, then if your foursome remains intact to the end, then whoever that fifth person is, like, is someone who's going to be, if not automatically inclined to go with you, at least less likely than Laura would have been. I think there are a few problems with that argument, though. The first is that if you do this now, then your alliance of four people is much less likely to make it to the end together in the first place, because you're only going to have four votes in a merge of potentially 10 or 12 people. It's going to be hard to ride that all the way to the end. And secondly, if you're switching permanently and you're going with Reynolds and Eddie, I don't feel like you want them in the end with you either. And you can't even try and boot them at Final Five, because either one of them is going to be the prohibitive favorite in a Final Immunity Challenge. So you'd have to do that earlier, at which point it's just as messy as it was before.
Mm-hmm. Okay, for me, when I'm making this decision, and thinking about the pros of booting Laura here, I think the biggest one for me, and this is, I think, the point that Steven has hinged his entire case on why booting Laura was good for Matt and Michael, which is that Eddie and Reynolds, when left on your team, are both good for you. They're going to try their hardest in any future challenges that you guys are on a team together for. And if you do end up swapping next round, they're going to be very good buffers for you in a swap. And I think buffers are an extremely underrated aspect of Survivor, like having someone, a bigger threat that you can point to, someone that's going to be a more pressing priority, that if you are in a minor, if people are going to be voting against your direction, they're going to not be putting the vote specifically on you. That's, you know, buffers are a phenomenal thing to have, particularly in an endgame. Point being here, those are definitely very strong arguments, which is that you want to be winning these challenges for now and you don't want to be getting voted out later, which is obviously very obvious, I guess. At the same time, for me, I do not feel like that justifies, for me, the age-old question of strength versus loyalty comes down to, unless this is a situation where I'm trying to hinder the public perception of a loyal tribe, which would only be the case in a three-starting tribe format, the answer to strength or loyalty is loyalty to me. And if I'm thinking a swap's coming up, but I know I have another challenge and only one person who won't be loyal, kind of like what we just talked about, I'm throwing that challenge without question.
Yeah, I did like the argument that if you end up on a swap tribe with Eddie and Reynolds, it's very easy to paint them as the ringleaders of your group and to draw in some of the favorites and get them booted instead of you. The trouble is, though, like, if you substitute Eddie and Reynolds there, you don't even have to go through all that work of, like, convincing people that Eddie and Reynolds were the leaders instead of you. You can just pick up whoever you want, and you have an alliance in place. You don't have to take any of those risks.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing, I think, that would definitely be weighing heavily on my mind is, we're not going to have numbers if we swap this next round. What are their priorities going to be if I leave Eddie and Reynolds in to be these buffers? The whole reason you're doing that, I think, is, of course, so that they get voted out before you. Now, I think when a favorites tribe has the numbers in a newly swapped tribe, if I'm Malcolm or something like that, or someone who's doing well within the favorites tribe, Eddie and Reynolds, the people who are on the outs or are, and certainly are as physically threatening as Eddie and Reynolds, are exactly the kind of people that I want with me post-merge, not post-swap. I'm trying to bring them along with me as, you know, to get more into this concept as buffers, if I'm specifically Malcolm, I guess, or Eric, or Shep, or maybe even anyone, yeah.
Yeah, well, also, if you manage to pick up some of the outsiders from the favorites tribe, and those are the people who are looking for new people to team up with, if they don't buy into this argument that Eddie and Reynolds need to be taken out immediately, then I feel like they're going to be more likely to go with the people who are loyal and strong in challenges, i.e. Eddie and Reynolds, because they need their group to be in a good position post-merge. They don't want to team up with people like Matt and Michael, have their tribe go down in flames again, and for them to just be left post-merge with no one they can really count on.
Yeah, and another thing that another consideration I would be making, and granted, it would be inaccurate based on what we've seen, from favorites camp, which is that they are at least a mildly cohesive unit, is if I'm on the fans tribe, I'm looking across at that cast of characters over there going, there's no fucking way these guys are going to be unified entering a swap. I would love to see a swap where it's like Eric, Brenda, and Corinne swap onto a team with both Reynolds and Eddie, and suddenly all these people that were on the bottom now have all the power.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just a thing that you want any time there's a swap, right?
Right. Well,
as a viewer.
Right, yeah, yeah. But I mean, we could swap such that an entirely new faction could form that we haven't, that hasn't had the chance to interact, that could end up running the game.
I guess the way to put it in simple terms is, what possible swap permutations are there where keeping Reynolds and Eddie over Laura actually helps you?
I feel like when thinking about that, that decision is weighted largely on how I think the favorites are likely to respond to Reynolds and Eddie. And I think if they're playing well, which I expect some of them to be, I would think they would want Reynolds and Eddie around for a while, and possibly at my expense.
Sure.
Especially because I don't like the idea, first of all, of lying about how Reynolds and Eddie were running the show, because Reynolds and Eddie are going to be right there telling them, no, that's not the case, and they have actual history and historical facts to back them up, and you have to make up this elaborate lie, go along with it with several other people, and maintain it for 39 days. Yeah, so I think that should just about do it for this week. Dom, I know definitely we don't want to get out of here without at least touching on what we saw in this week's preview. The next time on Survivor, it is Brandon going banana sandwich. He's pouring the rice out. He's flipping chairs. It looks like he's going to it's as Rob Cisternino tweeted out, hashtag Hansageddon, and I can't wait. And Dom, big announcement, joining us to talk about whatever we see coming up in tomorrow night's episode, returning to the show, Coach Wade. I cannot wait for that. Dom, thoughts on that and then anything else before we get out of here?
Yeah, this is going to be awesome. I would say that if the preview is misdirection and nothing like this actually happens, then great job to the editors, but it would actually be terrible job to the editors because it would be the biggest case of blue balls that the viewers have ever experienced. Like, I think a lot of people are quite disenchanted with the season at the moment, and they're really looking for tomorrow's episode to really light the fire underneath it, and hopefully it will, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Definitely. So, yeah, I think that's going to do it for this week, and we will talk to you guys next week with Coach. And for Dom, I'm Colin. Take care, guys.